Hello, I'm Richard Ady. This is RN. Welcome to Best Practice.
At first I was afraid, I was petrified. Kept thinking I could never live without you by my side. But then I spent so many nights thinking how you did me wrong. And I grew strong, and I learned how to get along. And so I'm back.
Gloria Gaynor kicks us off because we're going to talk about some tough issues today. Later on, why some women sabotage other women at work. I'll be walking fairly carefully through that one. We begin with something bigger and broader. In fact, it would be a rare workplace where it isn't going on, and that's incivility. So, rudeness, bullying, exclusion, you'll have seen this at some point. You may well have been through it yourself. Christine Porath, who's in the business school at Georgetown University, has been looking at the cost of incivility and at what you can do about it.
I think incivility at work is extremely important. It's very costly to organizations and to people, their health, their well-being, but it certainly hits the bottom line.
Because I imagine that some people that you meet must say, some people listening now might say, well, hang on, some people are just rude. That's life.
It is life, but it costs organizations an awful lot of money because of healthcare costs. So stress really impacts the bottom line with respect to incivility at work. Also, performance is a huge cost. People, even if they want to do their best work, when they're working around incivility, they have a really tough time focusing. And so it robs them of cognitive focus. That impacts performance and creativity. Also, incivility is extremely costly in terms of turnover. So about 12% of people who experience incivility say that they have left the organization as a result of the incident.
Right. That is real. I think I've seen research that has linked stress of and incivility, of course, is a big feeder into stress that raises the risk of cardiovascular disease.
Absolutely. And it can chip away at people's immune system. So, you know, in general, small stressors like incivility over time lead to things like even cancer and other diseases, as well as heart disease.
Where are we with this? Because I'm sure that a lot of people might think, well, people have always been rude, but are we ruder now?
Unfortunately, I found over the last 15 years or so a real increase in incivility in the workplace. And I think that stems from a variety of things. Globalization. So, you know, a lot of people now are working in teams or organizations with people from various cultures. And we all bring different norms and expectations for civility and respect. I think also we have different generations working in the workplace. And so people point their finger at, you know, the millennials as being a little bit more narcissistic. And there is some research to suggest that, you know, people behave differently according to different norms for age groups. I think a huge reason is technology. So most of us feel like we're always on, and that causes people enormous stress. And stress is actually the number one reason that people cite for being uncivil. So when I ask people, you know, what caused you to be uncivil, over 60% claim that they're just overworked or overwhelmed and stressed out.
Yeah, and I mean, I think we all know this. Once you have been rude to somebody or kind of lost your temper or even kind of lost it just a little, it's much easier to lose it again.
Yes, unfortunately, we all, I think, face that.
All right. Well, what are the usual responses, Christine?
Unfortunately, about half of people will decrease effort when they experience incivility. So they pull back, they give less. About 80% of people lose time worrying about the incident. And I think sometimes this is because we're not sure exactly how to handle it. Oftentimes, you know, we may feel like we were slighted or disrespected, but we're not sure, you know, how personally to take it or how we should have responded in the moment. Many people worry about what are the career implications for this, but I think most people tend to rethink it and in general lose time worrying whether it's about the person that offended them or, you know, how they should handle that person moving forward. And then, you know, a large number of people will leave the workplace as a result of this. So unfortunately, all of these things take a real toll on performance and the organization's bottom line.
What about if you're thinking, well, hang on, I'm not going to cop this, I'm going to confront it? I mean, that might feel like it might work.
Yes, it might feel like it will work. Unfortunately, in my data, only about 15% of people are satisfied when they confront the offender, if you will. So in general, I try to encourage people to focus on themselves. You know, ideally, they do get the information to the person, because oftentimes it wasn't intentional. It might have been the person didn't know that they were disrespectful or offensive. But it's often useful to get the information to the organization, who could get it to them directly.
All right. So all of this adds up to your approach, which is, I suppose, trying to make yourself so that it doesn't worry you as much.
Absolutely. I think the most effective response is to focus on what's under your control. And so across studies, what I found is that those that have a stronger sense of thriving, a sense of progress or development where people feel energized, that's the most effective strategy and resource for people. So doing things like identifying areas of your growth and pursuing development on those areas where you're feeling good about yourself is great. Working closely with a mentor is another strategy which is useful. I think it's really important for people that feel disrespected to manage their own energy, so take care of themselves, whether that means, you know, exercising, kind of working it out, making sure they're getting sleep, eating well, really making sure that health-wise they're taking care of themselves. Trying to find meaning or a sense of purpose in one's work is also helpful. So when things aren't going well, are there aspects of your job that you have that feel good or that you can create to help feel better about your situation? I think it's also very important to seek positive relationships and support, because we know that these de-energizing or disrespectful relationships, it takes, you know, over four times the toll on you as a positive relationship supports you. And then finally, I think it's very useful to think about how you can thrive outside of the workplace, because you can control that. And when you're feeling good in your personal life, you bring that energy and vitality into the workplace. And so it makes you have a tougher skin and more resilience in the face of some pretty challenging or disrespectful actions that you may have with others.
Now, what about journaling or something like that? So if you're copying it from somebody's being horrible to you, and you've convinced yourself, you've probably spent too much time thinking about it actually, that they're doing it on purpose, and you don't think that responding in kind will be helpful, your research seems to support that, is it worth just getting a book and writing it all down?
Yes, I think that there's some past U.S. presidents that have been notorious for this, kind of journaling it out. And I think that that is a good strategy, particularly if you have to kind of work your anger out. You know, I think the only caution that I would have with that is to make sure that you don't find yourself doing that continually. Like, you try to also find some positive avenues. So journaling is helpful, particularly around making sense of it and trying to figure out what your next steps are. But I wouldn't want people to be doing that for months on end. That's useful in the short term, and then focusing on some other long-term strategies is wise.
Yeah, because if you are doing it for a long time, you are really dwelling on it. And that is not helpful to you, is it?
Not helpful at all. In fact, you know, one of the biggest surprises in my research has been that it's not so much that incivility is a story of retaliation. I mean, yes, a lot of people get even with both the person that offended them and the organization, but the biggest cost is actually the fact that people can't focus. Like, incivility robs people of cognitive resources. And so I think if you're journaling all the time about it, it may cause you to dwell on it and suck the energy and life out of you, you know. And so, you know, trying to get your mind focused on other positive aspects of your life, of your work, and of where you can go with respect to your work, whether it's in that organization or another healthier situation for yourself, I think is the best kind of area for you to focus on, you know, to really be betting on yourself and focusing on yourself and your progress.
I think you quote a colleague or somebody who you met, and you were talking about this, and he said to you, you can visit Pity City, but you shouldn't want to live there.
Yes, I love that saying. And when you brought up journaling, I immediately thought of Tina Sung, who was the person that mentioned this to me. I thought it was really wise. She had used it to get her team through some very tough situations, including some very challenging mergers and acquisitions, a number of them. And I thought it really applies to this particular situation when you face, you know, whether it's just feeling disrespected or continually having to work with a jerk at work, the idea that you can't dwell on this. You have to keep moving.
This is your area of research and you've been doing it for some time. Are you finding that workplaces, that corporates are starting to take this more seriously?
Absolutely. So it's been very rewarding to see that over the past almost 20 years now, the organizations are really focusing on how to move from good to great on this continuum. Most organizations recognize that even if they're listed as one of the top places to work, unfortunately, you know, there are always some colleagues that might be rude or might be kind of bringing certain teams down. And so I think in general, managers are really trying to attack this and are looking to, you know, try to create more positive civil environments. And a lot of that most recently is also about, you know, really making sure that we're inclusive for those that are, you know, maybe different from us. And so really quite forward looking as far as how do we make more positive environments for people.
Christine, how did you get interested in this? Because it's an unusual area.
It is. Yes, it's very much a personal story. So after graduating from college, sports was my passion. I played college sports, and I thought I scored my dream job, which was working with the largest sports management and marketing firm in the world. But after graduating, I followed my boss down to a subsidiary to launch a sports academy. And unfortunately, at that subsidiary, it was quite a toxic culture with a narcissistic leader. And it really showed me just how much rude environment impacts people, not only their work life, but also oftentimes their personal life. And even though I was very young and naive, I just felt like we could and should do better. And I also grew up around this. So my dad, unfortunately, had worked for two very uncivil bosses over the course of, you know, a couple decades. And unfortunately, I saw the health toll it took on him, even though he was a strong, healthy guy. And so, you know, the combination of my work experience coupled with the fact that I saw loved ones go through this, it made me realize that probably all too many people are facing this. And so really wanted to try to show in as objective a way as possible, what are the costs of incivility and what are the benefits for managers and leaders that take this seriously and really work to build positive environments for people? Because I think that there are real wins for people and organizations.
I have to say, you are pushing in an open door with me, because I have long felt the ideal situation is to work with nice people, but working with nice people has been very underrated. Perhaps that's changing.
I certainly believe it is, and I'm trying to do all that I can to show that. And we've had some most recent research that shows that civility pays, and I think that that's a really strong message. I teach MBAs at my university, and I think a lot of them come into the program thinking, I'm afraid of being the nice guy or gal in the office, and maybe I won't seem leader-like enough that way. And in fact, all of the research that we've been doing in a variety of industries is showing that people that are perceived as more civil are seen more than twice as much as leaders, that people are more likely to share and seek information from them, and that they do perform better as rated by their bosses. And this is across different industries, across different cultures. So I think it's very promising in the sense that we're learning that, in fact, you know, civility does pay and that it is very positive. You know, we see team collaboration and creativity go up when people are working in these contexts. So I hope that, you know, the message continues to grow. And I do believe organizations are doing a great job on this front.
Well, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Christine Porath is an Associate Professor of Management in the Business School at Georgetown University. And I'm Richard Adie. This is Best Practice, RN show on management and work on your radio, on your app of choice, and online. That don't kill me, can only make me stronger. I need you to hurry up, man, because I can't wait much longer. Now to something that's a bit trickier to talk about, women sabotaging each other at work. This is something that happens, but it rarely gets mentioned. Well, the woman you're about to meet has been changing that. Actually, I say you're about to meet her, but you may have met her already, in a way. Let me show you what I mean. Siri, who does your voice?
Me, at least I thought it was me. I know, is this what an existential crisis feels like?
Actually, that's Karen Jacobson. She does Siri's Australian accent. Even more people hear her around the world because her voice is used by GPS devices from TomTom, Garmin and Navman. She's been called the only woman who men will take directions from. Karen's on the board of the Elevarco Foundation, which promotes and supports women in the tech world. And it was a conversation with Elevarco's founder Marissa Warren that led to her speaking out about women sabotaging each other. So how much of a problem is this?
I think pretty much any woman you speak with, well, probably any human being, but definitely any woman you speak with is going to have their own story. I live in New York City, and Marissa Warren, the founder of Elevarco, also was living in New York City. And we were both a part of an amazing group there called Australian Women in New York. And the very first day Marissa had arrived to come to one of these events, we got chatting in the elevator, as you do. And I said, I'm so glad you're here because this group is such a supportive, incredible group of people. Anything you need, any connection you need, there's somebody who's ready to put their hand up to help you. And she was really surprised to hear that because of her experience of really not ever having been helped once by a more senior woman. And so we became friends after that day and colleagues, and this led to her starting an interview series and asking to interview me specifically about this topic, about women sabotaging women.
And what was your own experience?
Well, I am from the entertainment business, and when I was first starting out in the recording studio scene in Brisbane and then in Sydney, you know, I really felt the pain, I suppose, of being the new girl. And the more experienced, some older, but definitely more experienced singers, there just really was not a, it wasn't common in my experience to have people putting their hand out to say, hey, let me help you, let me show you the way. Now, it wasn't that it never happened, but it wasn't the culture. And in my own experience, I have two particular studio owners I had come across who, both male, were extraordinarily helpful and pivotal in my success and in building my own business during those years. So for me, that was my pathway, was really seeing men willing to say, hey, I see some potential in you, let me help you and open some doors, and definitely not so much with women.
So you and Marissa did this interview and it got people talking, didn't it?
It got people talking to the point where we found ourselves at the Harvard Club in Midtown Manhattan and speaking at an event with other women, executives from tech companies, and really beginning this conversation that then led to the foundation of Elevarco.
Is this a particular issue in tech? Because one does think of tech as more of a male thing.
Well, I think it is. Let me look at my stats here. 3% of tech firms are founded by women. So, yes, and 40% are less likely to be funded than male-led companies. However, women-led firms are 15% more profitable than male-led firms. So Elevarco itself has now identified a lot of the challenges that women face in building their tech companies, and confidence is a really big one.
Well, one of the issues is, it seems, and you can hear how ginger I am with this, women sabotaging or undermining other women. Do we know why this is happening?
When there is scarcity, it breeds competition. And in much of business, but look, in a business like this where there are far fewer women, it can tend to breed that kind of environment. Scarcity definitely creates a competition that's not always a pleasant kind of competition. And I know for myself, you know, there's one really amazing opportunity and 10 extremely talented women up for that opportunity. It's very difficult, you know, very difficult.
Caroline Turner, who writes about gender in the Huffington Post, says that some women, after making it to the top, are more likely to pull the ladder up.
Yeah. Look, all I can suggest is that, you know, there's a self-protection side of things and a concern for maintaining that position.
There's also apparently survey evidence that shows that women are much less likely than men to be happy to have a woman boss.
Hmm. Look, I think that women can be really open and really willing to share from the heart. And then I think that there's this absolute fear of being betrayed, because women can hold a grudge. All people can, but it's certainly, I've done a lot of communication and leadership classes over the years. And one of the really interesting insights that I had was learning that, you know, boys, when they're playing on the playground, somebody will kick somebody else's shins and, you know, they're not happy about it for about a minute. And then they stand up and then they're all playing together again. They're not really hanging on to that, incident. Girls will have something happen and they will not forget it.
Yeah, I've read this elsewhere too. There can be a bit of a difference between how the different genders deal with conflict. Boys and men are more likely to be direct, and girls and women are more likely to avoid conflict or to handle it in a way which doesn't lead to immediate resolution. Now, this is broad brush, isn't it? Because
of
there
course.
Are plenty of women who do that. But as a tendency, that's what apparently has been seen.
Exactly. And women are sensitive. I think we can all see that women can be more sensitive or seem to be very sensitive. So I can understand that self-protection showing up. But as we are progressing into I would like to hope, the best age we've ever been in for every gender to have an ability to pursue what they want to pursue, to build the kind of business or purpose-driven life that they want to have, that we can actually focus on our similarities and not our differences and be able to all coexist in that, as I would call it, an everybody wins kind of environment.
Now, Karen, we've been talking about women, but it's not as if men don't sabotage each other. Of course they
exactly,
do.
Exactly.
You know, it's a competitive world. There are only, you know, so many positions in the C-suite, and there's going to be X number of guys who think they can get it, and they are trying to sabotage one another.
Yeah, and look, here's what we've been dealing with historically is very male-dominant business environment. And we're now seeing a real shift in that. But those older, more established networks and ways of supporting their buddies to rise up together and taking care of the guys, that was established over a very long period of time. So we're only now just getting into an age where we're seeing women's networks, I think, actually building to a point where there is the opportunity for more of a level playing field.
And that's what Elevarco's all about. But what about this broader problem we've been talking about, Karen? This issue in which there certainly seems to be enough reporting of women sabotaging other women in the workplace. They can't all be part of Elevarco. It's not all women work in tech. So what can we do?
I'm such a solution-oriented person. I love that question. I think that creating a safe space for discussion in the media and in the business media as well is a really big step forward. I think that people can be very, even yourself, you just said a little bit earlier, you're kind of treading carefully. And I think we do tread carefully because we don't want to say something insensitive or inappropriate. And because we are in new territory, we aren't sure sometimes what is appropriate. And I think to be able to create that safe environment for discussion and to just continue communication skills and communication training, that is massive. You know, communication really can be the gateway to solve anything.
Well, belling the cat, as you've done today, is certainly a good start. Thank you very much for joining me.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Karen Jacobson. She's known as the GPS girl. You can leave a comment or find out more on our homepage, abc.net.au/rn. Best Practice is produced by Mudita Dias. Our sound engineer is Amrita Bettencourt. I'm Richard Ady.